2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 371, Telling Joseph Smith's Story, Five Biographers Reflect. A panel discussion featuring Richard L. Bushman, Robert V. Remini, Richard Dutcher, Richard Van Wagener, and Scott Kinney.
Telling Joseph Smith's Story, Five Biographers Reflect. The first speaker will be Richard L. Bushman, Professor Emeritus of American Colonial History. His major books are From Puritan to Yankee, The Refinement of America, Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, was a landmark work in Mormon studies. He is now writing a cultural biography of Joseph Smith, expected to be published in 2005. Professor Robert V. Remini, Professor Emeritus of University of Illinois at Chicago, is the author of the most recent book, Joseph Smith. It's published by Viking, and it should be out on the 14th of August or the 15th of August, of October. And there will be a book signing on the 18th of October, place and location to be announced. He has also written The Course of American Empire, a three-volume series, The Battle of New Orleans, Andrew Jackson and America's First Military Victory, Andrew Jackson and His Indian Wars, Henry Clay, Statesman for the Union, Daniel Webster, The Man and His Time. Among others. Thank you. Richard Dutcher will address us third. LDS filmmaker, writer, and director, and actor. He's a return missionary from Mexico. He has done God's Army, Brigham City. He is currently making a film on Joseph Smith. Richard Van Wagener has written A Book of Mormons, Mormon Polygamy, A History, Lehi, Portraits of a Utah Town, Sidney Rigdon, A Portrait of a Religious Excess, and Pioneering Lehi City, A 150-Year Pictorial History. The last on the panel is Scott Kinney, representing three authors that started their work on Joseph Smith the 1st of January, 2002. We all know Scott Kinney's work on as editor of Wilford Woodruff's journals from 1833 to 1898. He is the founder and first editor of Sunstone and co-founder of Signature Books. We have an illustrious panel. We will begin as indicated in the order from my left to right.
Well, it's a great pleasure to appear on this panel with other biographers of Joseph Smith. I'm delighted that he's attracting so much attention. His upcoming 200th anniversary of his birth is, I'm sure, part of the magnet. But he's a man of such immense dimensions and so much complexity that he certainly deserves as many perspectives on him as possible. I'm particularly pleased to be on the same program with Robert Remini, who has been the most open-handed and open-hearted biographer I've ever met in terms of seeking advice and counsel and asking for perspectives on his work. And the wonderful part of that style of his is that he gets to know so many people, and we've gotten to know him, so it's a pleasure to be here and finally meet him in person. We did both appear on the same television screen in Lee Groberg's The American Prophet, and that's where Bob spoke the most memorable lines in the entire video. How did he do it? And really, that question is the one that every biographer must face. How did he do it? The title of the video, An American Prophet, itself I find perplexing. Half of the title is most certainly accurate and descriptive. The other half is debatable, even puzzling. I think there's no doubt that Joseph Smith was a prophet. The question is, was he an American? Speaking as a historian, I see no reason to question Joseph Smith's prophet. If anyone in American history, or world history, for that matter, was a prophet, Joseph seems to have qualified. America's had more than its share of prophets, people who had divine knowledge revealed to them. We began with Anne Hutchinson in the first generation and continued down through Jemima Wilkinson of the Shakers and Nat Turner, the prophetic black revolutionary, John Brown, Ellen White of the Seventh-day Adventists, and into the 20th century with Martin Luther King. And among all of these, every prophetic voice that you can assemble, Joseph Smith certainly stands out. In fact, I think he stands with the prophets of all time, Muhammad, Isaiah, Moses, for the extent and the radical nature of his revelations. Are there any figures in world history that are more prophetic than Joseph Smith? Let me tell you some of the thoughts that lie behind that statement. I marvel, for example, at his clear prophetic voice. The first revelation he recorded, so far as we can tell, is the current section 3 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And he opens that with such certainty and clarity. The works and the designs and the purposes of God cannot be frustrated, neither can they come to naught. Or the preface to the Doctrine and Covenants, section 1. Hearken, O ye people of my church, saith the voice of him who dwells on high and whose eyes are upon all men. Those are extraordinarily powerful words to come from such a young man with no experience in preaching. We have no evidence that Joseph had preached a sermon before the church was organized in 1830. Yet from the very beginning, he had no trouble in speaking for God. Seemingly effortlessly, he creates a rhetorical space where only God speaks. Joseph's absences himself entirely from the language. He stands in this rhetorical space only as the recipient. Only God is speaking. And that ability to speak for God with perfect certainty is the prophetic gift par excellence. No one exercises it with more clarity and ease than Joseph Smith. Secondly, the evidence for the power of those words is the reception by his followers. When he spoke in that voice, they knew the voice was of God's. And the remarkable thing is that so many of the revelations were received more or less publicly. That is, in a group of a small council of maybe 6 or 8 men, and he would simply sit down and dictate a revelation. and they would see him. They would maybe be the ones who were writing it down. And yet, though it was so pedestrian, you know those circumstances, little crowded, stuffy, hot rooms somewhere above a store, here and there, and yet those words came forward and they accepted them as the authoritative word of God. There's that famous moment when Joseph Smith is coming up after the Book of Mormon has just been published and he's going to organize the church, and he meets Martin Harris with this pile of books stumbling on along the road, and Martin says, "They won't sell. No one will buy them." And he says, "I want a commandment." That was their name for revelations in those days. And Joseph says, "Martin, don't worry. They will sell in good time." Of course, Martin's got some number of thousands of bucks invested in this Book of Mormon, so he has a little more of a stake in it. He says, "I want a commandment." So Joseph receives section 19. And Martin is calmed and pacified. Or John Whitmer, he's called to be, by Joseph, to be the historian of the church. And John Whitmer doesn't want to be historian of the church. He says, "I've got to have a commandment." So the same man, with the same voice that had asked him to do it, receives a revelation, a commandment to John Whitmer, and then John Whitmer goes along. Somehow, these early men and followers in general could distinguish between that prophetic voice and the ordinary counsel of Joseph Smith. Well, I think it is surely one sign of a prophet that he inspires that confidence in the people around him. And the remarkable thing is Joseph exposed himself so fully to them, and still they heard those words as the word of God. Thirdly, prophets have the power to alter reality. They don't just enthrall people for a moment. It isn't just a sermon that excites the audience and moves them to some kind of change, but they create new worlds for their believers, new worlds in which they can exist. They disrupt old realities and create these new ones. They decenter the world, the phrase we've come to use a little bit. Well, we all know that Joseph had this talent for creating historical realities. The Book of Mormon, 1,000 years of a complete civilization, brings it into existence and then brings it crashing down at the end. That in its, is a marvelous thing for a 23-year-old semi-literate to accomplish. But then he goes on with the Book of Moses and all the Enoch stories, and then Abraham comes out of nowhere. So he has that capacity to create historical realities in the past, but he also could alter realities in the present. He created new worlds for his followers, and they organized their lives around the world Joseph Smith creates. He creates a new space. He creates this great vortex, turns the world into a funnel. He wants everyone to come down in that funnel into that central gathering place where the city was with its temple. Well, this capacity to have people reorient their lives to a revealed world, to pick up, move, undergo suffering, work under hardships, that is truly a prophetic gift. Well, all that adds up in my mind to prophetic authority, so far as that word appears in a dictionary or is used in common speech. I think when Richard Broadhead this past May at the MHA delivered his address, there was no question in his mind that Joseph Smith was a prophet. He linked him to all other prophets. Joseph applied the word to himself. His followers called him a prophet. His enemies called him a prophet. They linked him with Muhammad going through time. So I think that he really passes virtually all the tests, and so it's very easy for a historian to say Joseph Smith must be considered in a biographical setting as a prophet and what impact does a prophet have on the lives that he affects. The adjective American is more problematic. I mean, surely he's American in some ways. He has that wonderful openness to all experience, a kind of a Walt Whitman-esque desire to encompass all knowledge, an aversion to the restraints of creeds. He delivers diatribes against creeds because they set limits on the human mind. He's also pragmatic in his basic outlook toward human existence, in the sense that there's no fixed reality that's just established by God and can't be changed, but that reality can be reshaped and turned to human purposes. He has that same that striving that is so characteristic of Americans, this being boundless in his expectations and hopes. And what is more American than to believe that common people could hold the priesthood? Every ordinary man could hold the priesthood. And what is more, they could see God. He was driven by that desire to bring his people into the presence of God. From the winter of 1831 on, that was his goal. So we could go on and list many American qualities. I think Robert Remini has done that in his book. And this is not to mention creating this document which offered Americans a new founding myth of the United States, a new deep history of this continent, quite different from all the standard varieties. So all of these things are very American in their tone and intention. But against all of the American qualities we can line up, we have to confront the fact of his alienation from American society. Why was it that Mormons could never find a peaceful home in the United States? Why were they driven from every settlement they made? We can account for every individual expulsion from Jackson County, Clay County, Far West, Nauvoo, by citing local factors, sort of immediate things, the opposition to slavery, or friendship with the Indians, or the closing of the expositor, or plural marriage. But when you add up this continuous sequence that extends into Utah, then we have to think that there's some deep contradiction that underlies these repeated confrontations between Mormonism and their American neighbors. Actually, I think the conflicts are not hard to find. They, to my mind, they lie right on the surface of the events. The people who are participating themselves voiced the basic objections. Americans believed Mormons were undemocratic, even anti-democratic. The nature of their society was fundamentally at odds with American society. And that all came back to Joseph Smith. The governors of Missouri kept telling the Mormons when they complained, why are people mistreating us so? Why don't you come to our rescue? They kept repeating the words, vox populi, vox Dei. The voice of the people is the voice of God. And Mormons simply did not subscribe to that American principle. The voice of the prophet was the voice of God, not the voice of the people. In the final analysis, it was believed by their neighbors, Mormons would follow Joseph Smith rather than the government. Revealed revelation set up what Sarah Gordon has so aptly called competing sovereignties. Who was supreme? The government of the United States or the prophet of God? In actual fact, the Mormons tried to avoid confrontation between these two sovereignties. They did their best, on most occasions, with only a few exceptions, to be law-abiding citizens, to live quietly in their communities. But their neighbors saw through to the heart of this contradiction. They immediately recognized that Joseph Smith and all the Mormons, according to their own principle, might choose not to conform to the law of the land because they believed in a higher law, the law of God as it was revealed through their prophet. Like all prophets and all believers in prophets, they're potentially revolutionaries who would overthrow the rule of law if necessary to establish the kingdom of God. It didn't matter whether or not anything was done about that. Very little done in Jackson County or Clay County or any of those places to establish the kingdom of God. And yet their neighbors saw this dangerous quality, why Mormons could not be trusted in government. Well, many prophets, maybe all prophets, have suffered from the same suspicion. They're more than suspicions. Prophets do resist the law of governments in order to honor the law of God. Nat Turner, John Brown enacted their revelations by taking up arms against slavery. Anne Hutchinson was expelled from Massachusetts when she finally admitted that she had received revelation. That was the confession that led to her expulsion. As an antinomian, one who is against the law, Mormonism's neighbors were really quite right to distrust the followers of Joseph Smith. They were, in theory, more dangerous at the polls than African Americans, to whom they were frequently compared. That is the sense in which I think Joseph Smith was fundamentally un-American. He challenged the most basic principle of democracy, that asserts the voice of the people is the voice of God. He was not opposed to elections or majority rule. He was both a small D and a large D Democrat. He accepted the Constitution and American government, and yet there remained this one reservation which his enemies immediately sensed. His first allegiance was to God and the God who spoke to him in his revelations. He thus overturned the most fundamental element of American identity, its belief in democracy as its deepest religious principle, the source of the nation's most fundamental values, was democratic. Like all prophets, he disrupted the world into which he was born. And how could one subvert the established order in America more fundamentally than to throw democracy itself into question? Thanks.
What an act to follow. I'm not going to repeat what I said earlier that would bore you all, but I want to use this opportunity to tell you how grateful I am to this man. Every time I had a difficult question and went to him, he answered it straight out. Sorry. And he introduced me to all the people at BYU who inundated me with books and articles. I didn't have to do any research. It was all there in my office. It was grand. And if I came up with a problem, I always used him as my last resort. Because as I told you earlier, some Mormons pussyfoot about certain things, and he never did. I owe him a great deal, and we only met about 20 minutes ago. So I owe him a great deal, and now I find I disagree with him. But I'm not going to do it in public. You'll see our respective works. I think Joseph Smith is uniquely a man of his time. I don't think anybody escapes. There are times. And I will say this about democracy. Mormonism is the most democratic religion I know. Everybody gets to heaven. Almost everybody. You have to really do some... I won't bring up Hitler. That would be inappropriate. But there are three heavens, so to speak. I mean, other churches, you don't belong to our church, you're out. You don't have the passport that says you belong to the right church. So I will leave it at that, and I'll leave it to your reading our respective accounts. And I'm so glad to hear that Richard expects to have his book on the 200th anniversary of the birth of this singular American religious figure. What I thought I would do that I didn't do earlier is talk about why people hated him so much and his religion. For one thing, you don't go around telling other people that their religions are false. It may be true, but you can't expect them to turn around and say, "Oh, that's nice to know. Thank you very much." And you know, in his history, he seems so naive. You know, the first thing he does is he goes to this minister and he tells him that he had an encounter with the divine. Now, in those days, there were a lot of people having an encounter with the divine, and there was nothing unusual about the fact that he was a young boy. But what he said infuriated the man. He said that your religion is wrong and that the ministers were corrupt. That's what he was told. And that the church from the first or second century departed from the Church of Christ and had to be restored. And guess who's going to do it? A 14-year-old boy. And you expect these people to say, what they said was, "Shut your mouth, or we'll shut it for you. What do you know about our religion?" What did he know? But he went to his mother, who had just become a Presbyterian. She held off so long. She becomes a Presbyterian, and he says to her, "Presbyterianism is not true. My associate at the University of Illinois is a Presbyterian, and a very good one." And I said, "You know what Joseph Smith had to say about Presbyterianism?" And he said, "Do you want to know what Presbyterianism has to say about Joseph Smith?" "I won't tell you." That's a good way to start. And then he says that their Bible, their holiest book, the St. James Version, is incomplete or incorrect or things are left out. How about that as a starter? And that's just a start. And the law couldn't rein him in. They tried again and again. It's amazing how many times they went to the law. And they finally took the law into their own hands. And you have to realize at that time, you're dealing with a very violent society. Just look what they did with slaves, blacks. Look what they did with the Indians, the Trail of Tears. Look what they did with the Catholics, the burning of the Ursuline convent in Massachusetts. These are not people who are going to take the message that they're wrong and I'm right. No religion is going to do that. Why should they? And especially that their clergy were corrupt. Well, they probably were. Clergy tend... Well, I won't get into it. You'll forgive me for these Easy jokes. Why was it so successful? I think the Book of Mormon is the beginning. He gave them a book that connected them with the divine. I read Karen Armstrong's book on Islam, and one of the things that really made people who were Arabs feel as though they were lesser than all their surrounding people was that the Jews had the Old Testament and the Christians had the New Testament. And what did they have? Nothing. And there were a lot of religions that came around during the Second Great Awakening, but none of them, not one, gave them something tangible by which they could read and understand and feel empowered by the divine. And they sacrificed their lives. You can go on for a lot of other reasons too, which I do in my book. But I think those are the two most powerful. The Book of Mormon is a unique work by an incredible individual at a very young age. As I told some of you earlier, reminds me of Mozart at the age of 3. He's composing masterpieces. Well, Joseph Smith wasn't 3. But he wasn't very old either. And he had very little experience. And yet he's chosen. It's really one of the great wonders and mysteries, I think, of life. If you believe in God, why does he choose some people to be his messengers and not others? And when some of those people seem to be so unworthy, I won't go into how I became somebody who saw Joseph Smith as an embodiment of some of the best things about this country, in that he wasn't afraid to speak his mind and tell people, whether they liked it or not, what the truth was as he saw it. And that's one of our great, great freedoms, that we can speak out. Because you may get killed in the process. But you got to remember, if you really believe, it makes a difference. And it's wonderful to go back to a period in religious history, and I'm not a religious historian, and find that there was a time when people really did think that it made a difference that they were on this planet and that they were here for a purpose. And a man comes along and helps them to define it. And that's, I think, what we're trying to do in this country. To help not only our nation, but individuals to achieve the best that is in them. And look at what Joseph Smith achieved in 38 years. God, I'm twice that age. What have I done? Scribble, scribble, scribble. So we have a difference, and I quite admit what Richard, Professor Bushman has said. I would remind you, too, that the head of the church is called a president, which happens to be an American term. and that there are other aspects that I won't, you know, I don't want to get into any kind of discussion at this point. But it seemed to me that democracy is not the one that I felt was appropriate. And there are others. It is true. The Mormons could not find a place to stay in this country. They had to go to Mexico to find relief. But the story, I think, that God really wanted, like the Jews of old, is send them packing again and again to really come to terms with what he wants them to do. I'm not trying to say what God, I hope not. But there's the old story of Saint Teresa of Avila when she was going to found another convent. And the donkey knocked her off the ground and she broke her leg. And she turned to God and said, "Did you have to knock me down? And on top of that, did you have to break my leg?" And God responded, "I do that to all my friends." Thank you very much.
I approach you with a little sadness today, but I suppose this is an appropriate forum in which to share something of a confession with you. I recently stumbled upon what was to me a very shocking revelation on an anti-Mormon website. I'd always felt that I was very widely read on LDS issues and aware of most of the controversies. But I learned something there that kind of pulled the rug out from under me and caused me to question everything that I once believed and that I publicly declared to be true. And I've consulted other specialists on the subject, and they also were unfamiliar with this. But this happened just as my film God's Army was beginning to enjoy some surprising success outside of Utah. And since that time, I've had to live with this information and try to make peace with it in my mind. And it's had a very great strain on my closest and most personal relationships, because on this website I learned that I, Richard Dutcher, am a fictional creation of the LDS Church. Now, apparently, there's an individual out there who has personal knowledge that I do not even exist and that I never have. I'm a pseudonym for one of the general authorities, apparently. And, needless to say, this has had quite a disruption in my family. My parents have disowned me. Again. And, my wife is devastated. She feels like I've deceived her for 15 years in telling her that I am a real man. She wanted to know why I never told her anything about my struggles over my fictional identity. My children also are struggling with this issue. They don't know what to do now that they know that they're half fictional. That's the extent of my prepared remarks. Not really. It was humorous to me, though. I guess somehow that individual failed to recognize that I actually played a part in that film. And, maybe he thinks you can do anything with computers nowadays. And that's almost true. Now, I don't know why I'm here. I was first approached to be on this panel quite some time ago, and I declined. And I thought, and I still feel a little strange being here. I have four children, and not that that has anything to do with my not being here, but actually we just finished with birthday season at my house. My children are all born together, 3 years apart, but at the same time of year. Apparently my wife ovulates once every 3 years, right during Thanksgiving. And for some reason, I get really affectionate after a good meal, so it's probably more information than you wanted to know. But I brought up my children because having four young children, we get a lot of Sesame Street in our house, and there's something that, a little song about, they'll throw up some objects and they'll say, you know, one of these things does not belong. You know, some of these things are just alike, and I can't remember exactly, but this is exactly how I feel today, because we've got some very distinguished and respectable historians here, and then somebody decided to throw in a movie maker. And I'm not I do not consider myself a historian. I consider myself a storyteller. And I do, although I do some of my own research, I have actually been known to go check sources at in collections, but most of my research is done from the work of ladies and gentlemen like these men up here. And I value their all the work that they put into it. So I feel a little bit in the wrong place. However, I am doing a film on the life of Joseph Smith, and the Sunstone folks said they wanted me to talk, and I said, well, I really don't want to, but will you give me a free ticket to the rest of the things? And they said, yeah, we'll do it. And I said, all right, I'll go. But hopefully I'll say something important. I have been accused of speaking, doing an entire presentation and never addressing the subject at hand, but I will, although I will hold back a little bit. Over the past few days, I've been cornered in probably every corner in this hotel. People trying to squeeze information out of me about this film. And I apologize to those of you who have cornered me, because I am a little tight-lipped about it. I don't like to talk about it too much, because there is a certain syndrome among storytellers that I'm afflicted with, which is, once you tell the story, whether it's to, you know, the entire world or to some guy in the corner by a telephone, some of the energy's gone. You lose some of the enthusiasm. And I don't like to do that. So I would much rather tell the entire world the story of Joseph Smith, at least as many as I can lure into a movie theater, than I would to tell a Sunstone symposium of a few hundred people. So I hope you'll understand. I will share some things with you. But if you ask me a question and I just kind of smile and look at my feet, then it's probably something I'm just going to hold on to. Because I want you to see the movie. I want you to be in suspense, in fact. I want lines around the theater, and I don't want you to wait until video like most of you did with Brigham City. That really hurt, by the way. So.